It's Tuesday, April 8th, 2014, and you're listening to episode 336 of Fear the Boot, a show about tabletop role-playing games and a little bit more. Running time for this episode is 40 minutes. Welcome to Fear the Boot. My name is Dan.
My name is Pat.
My name is Stu.
All right, we are continuing our episode with Happy Jacks, though we lost Kimmy because she had a choice of either come back and join the podcast or not die at the hands of Stu's wife.
Yep.
So, Stu, I'll let you explain that one. So for anyone who doesn't keep up with what you guys do, both you and your wife are very heavily involved in the Ren Faire scene out there in California.
Yes, we both work at the Renaissance Pleasure Faire, which is in Irwindale, California. And it runs 7 weekends starting this Saturday. And my wife has a band called the Merry Wives of Windsor, and I have a band called the Poxy Boggards. And there's sort of a friendly competition for that. As we get closer and closer to the fair, and we're both trying to rush to get everything ready and be prepared for once that we have to actually start doing shows, that competition becomes sometimes a little less friendly and a little more strained. This is the rehearsal night, so...
Okay, so I have to ask, because I've wondered this every time you have said the name of this thing, the Pleasure Fair?
Yes.
Okay, I'm picturing, like, this is like Hedonism 6 or something. Why Renaissance Pleasure Fair?
I don't know where the name originally came from. I can give you a clue that it started in 1964.
Okay, so it probably was an accurate name, and society just sort of morphed, and that's not what goes on there anymore. It's less than naked people in the mud. And
yeah, I mean, I think it probably had more of a hippie aspect in the 60s and 70s and 80s and 90s than it does in the 2000s and 2010s. I mean, I've been doing it for about 23 years now.
Wow.
And back in the day, you hear stories about how crazy it used to be, and it really isn't as crazy as the stories from the past reflect, at least not in my experience.
So continuing from where we left off last episode, I was working through a survey whose results were posted by your friend Lane on Reddit, and this was a survey of about 1,000 GMs. And last time we worked through some of the kind of higher level questions. This time I want to work through a list that's equally as long. We might move through it quicker, might not. I guess we'll just see how this goes. But this is the responses to a single question. What's your single biggest frustration as a GM? And these are the top 11 responses
Good night.
That were given. All right. And I don't know if these are in order that they were ranked. So I don't know if the order here is significant or not. But all right, let's start with the first one, which does not surprise me in the least. Players. Absent players. Rules lawyers. Distracted players. Min-maxers. Cheaters. As he puts it, the details changed, but the theme remained a constant. I would throw in there another one, which we've talked about in Fear of the Boot, which is in addition to rules lawyers, the setting lawyers. Absent players for me has really not been too big of a problem. I'll be completely honest and admit that, generally speaking, my attendance is a bigger problem than most of my players. I will fully and openly admit that. Distracted players, however, yes. Min-maxers and cheaters earlier in my gaming career, but not so much now. Rules lawyers, that's never really been a problem. Out here and there, yes, not really been a problem for me. The few lawyers I've encountered have been setting lawyers.
I've had my share of min-maxers, quite a few of them. Some of them have been remarkably good role players as well, but they really know how to go in with the mechanics and make the most combat effective character they possibly can. Depending on which system I'm playing, sometimes that's a big struggle for me. And that's one of the reasons I think I kind of shy away from certain game systems now.
You know, as a game master, the min-maxers don't bother me if they're also role-playing. I think the min-maxers only bother me as a game master, and I'll explain why I'm putting that caveat in there. If they're min-maxing at the expense of the other aspects of the game, such as role-playing and developing their characters, then I just feel like they're just playing the numbers, they're not playing a person. Now, the caveat I put in there of as a game master is I have noticed that oftentimes these same min-maxers can frustrate the other players because the other players start to feel superfluous to the action because of the fact that so-and-so really knew how to nail their character so perfectly. And other people at the table either don't know it that well or in the interest of making a more plausible character, intentionally didn't min-max, that they find that in a lot of situations they just aren't all that useful. Therefore, their ability to contribute to the game, usually it's combat, not always, could be non-combat situations as well, starts to get minimized.
I've seen that frustration in players' eyes. I ran a Savage Worlds game where actually one of our hosts, Tappy, from a couple years ago, made a character in Savage Worlds, and he totally gamed the system when he made the character. The party was fighting giants or something like that. And it was, I think there were two of them. And he had min-maxed it in such a way that he was rolling multiple D4s rather than any other die. And a D4 explodes 25% of the time.
Right.
So, and he was rolling many of them. I don't remember exactly what combination of things he had to have as many as he did. But he showed me, and I just don't remember it. But he rolled, and like of his like four dice that he was rolling, three of them exploded, and he one-shotted a giant. And the rest of the players are looking at him like, oh, that was our big fight of the night.
I've seen players do things like that on luck, but it's been a while since I've seen somebody min-max like that. I have seen somebody do it. There was a guy that min-maxed a troll in Shadowrun in one of my games, and it wasn't even about the character class. He wasn't playing a physical adept or anything like that, but he just managed to min-max his hand-to-hand combat skills and such, just using, I mean, really kind of run-of-the-mill sorts of rules, to the point that I don't remember between him and his cyberware how many dice it was he was rolling to stage his damage upward. Because the way it works in Shadowrun is every attack has like a base damage amount, and based on the number of successes you roll, you stage it up. So instead of a moderate wound, it becomes a heavy wound or a severe wound or whatever. And he could basically just one shot flatten almost anything he touched. So number two is finding inspiration. We talked about this one last time. I found modules are a great place for inspiration, even if you're not using the plots in them. The plot hooks, the artwork. Artwork's a big inspiration for me. If I can find a relevant movie, if I'm about to run a Star Trek game, I almost always put in one of the Star Trek movies. Even just having that on in the background helps a lot. One of the best campaigns I've ever run in my GMing career, Transformers campaign. I watched and rewatched, at least had on in the background, the original cartoon Transformers movie. It was just from having that on in the background that eventually, and it wasn't anything taken directly from the movie. I mean, it wasn't like I saw something in the movie like, oh yeah, I'm going to use that. But I think it was just more kind of having my brain immersed in that genre and the fiction and all of that just kind of got me thinking that direction and gave me ideas for plots that, once again, weren't taken directly from anything I was watching. But I think it just being in that environment sort of pushed me in the right direction.
One of the most useful sources of inspiration for me, and this doesn't work for a new campaign, but it certainly works when you've gone a ways, is forgotten and ignored plot hooks that you've already dropped, that the players have forgotten and moved on in some other direction. Take them, have the story advance, have the problem, whatever the problem was that they could have addressed, get worse so that it gets to the point now they have to address it.
Even before I get to the forgotten ones, I start with explicit ones. It's part of my requirement as a GM that if you're going to play in my game, when you write a character, you are going to give me at least two, preferably three, plot hooks for your character. And it could be anything. You owe money to somebody, you're estranged from your spouse, a family member's missing, I don't care what it is. Year of your life, you can't remember. Whatever it is, you're going to give me some things that I can work with. And that right there oftentimes gives me inspiration for plots, or at least subplots, and sometimes full plots, because what I can do is I don't want to center the campaign around one player, but if I look at the characters as a group, I might start to notice either trends within their plot hooks, or I might ask a different question of, okay, this guy can't remember year of his life, this guy's estranged from his wife, this guy owes somebody a lot of money. How do I tie those three things together?
Mm-hmm.
And if I can find some way to build those into a cogent plot, boom, there's my campaign arc.
What I was thinking was to go in and mine the 5 or 6 page backstory you got from the players and see if there's plot hooks in there, but actually asking them for them. That's brilliant. I've never done that.
Yeah. Well, the one problem I've had with mining their own backstories is that awkward moment when you're at the table and you're like, okay, Sir Clarence shows up.
Who?
Yeah, and even the guy that wrote the backstory is giving you this blank look. I'm like, Sir Clarence. Mm-hmm. The guy on page 4, third paragraph, he was your tutor. You guys, you know, same church, you come from the same order. Order of St. Clarence named after him? Ringing any bells? Can you pass me that back so I can re-skim it? Damn it.
That's funny.
Tell me this has never happened to you, Stu.
Well, I had one session that was all set up to explore one character's backstory. It was the one elf in the game, and she didn't show up to the session.
Oh, that's another one. Yeah. They don't show up. I think somehow, though, that's at least less awkward than they don't remember their own back. It's like, you took the time to write this 10-page backstory. I had to sit there and suffer through reading your 10-page backstory. I highlighted the 4 interesting sentences, and now you don't remember them. What was the point of this exercise?
You asked for a backstory.
Yeah.
I didn't know you were going to use it. What are you talking about?
Why would the game master ask for some? I mean, surely they just want more to read, more to fill up their prep time, right? They're not actually going to use this information.
I'm actually kind of flummoxed that you read it. if my backstories are more than half a page or a full page,
I don't anymore. I had to start setting hard upper limits. For some of my players, I still have to keep in place lower limits, but for many of them, I've had to put in place upper limits. And so I'll say, look, I want, you know, one paragraph of personality, no more, no less. And this should be a proper paragraph. Just never hitting enter tab does not count as one paragraph. And for backstory, give me maybe 1 to 3, you know, and once again, we're talking properly. If you can't fit it on a page in 11 or 12 point font or something like that, reasonably spaced, then it's too much. You know, I'm not going to remember it. You're not going to remember it. If you want to write a novella about your character, I'm completely fine with that. Don't do it for this game. Just carry that with you and go write a short story for somebody later or whatever. Write your own fanfic. I don't care, but don't give it to me as a GM. I've got enough to keep track of.
Right.
This ties right into the next one. General prep. Time was the most recurring issue with inspiration not far behind. Doesn't surprise me in the least. Mm. And on the flip side, the next one, over planning. Fleshing out entire locations or adventures that the party bypasses entirely is a huge source of frustration.
Yes.
Understandably so. I found there's 2 ways to help that. One is don't overplan. Don't come to the game with these massive notebooks full of information. Have a little bit of information on everything instead of a lot of information on everything. And if you have something really interesting and the party bypasses it, we've talked repeatedly about the portability of game elements.
Yeah, yeah.
Suddenly an NPC moves from town A to town B. Town A moves from town A to town B. A plot moves from here to there. I mean, the players don't know any better.
No.
Tell them you have to take a dump and figure out how you're going to rework it while you're sitting there sweating in the bathroom for 5 minutes.
Like you said, you have to be flexible and go with the flow. It's like we talked about in the last episode. We mentioned that one of the high points for GMs was reacting to what the players do in the story, that they love this apparently. So that, I mean, that's what you got to focus on is being flexible with it and literally being able to sort of work on your feet and change. Because like you said, Dan, until it comes out of your mouth that this town has this important thing going on to it that you just came to, no one knows that it was actually this other town except for you.
Right.
And they'll never know because it is now canon because you've said so in the game.
I used to be a chronic over prepper. And I would come to the table with, 15, 20 pages worth of stuff. Back when I was playing 4th edition D&D, there's a lot of, like, monster stats and things like that as well. But there would be all kinds of narratives about who this person is and you know, what event is transpiring at this point and all of this stuff. And it's like the player and his 7-page backstory. By the time I sit down, I don't remember half of what I wrote anyway.
Yeah.
So why did I bother writing it?
I started there as well. My reason for starting that way, I actually blame the game. My first role-playing game was the fastest Star Trek game. And yeah, I know a lot of people pick up role-playing kind of as an oral tradition where they fall into the group of role players and pick it up from them and then pass it on to other people. We started pretty raw. We got the game. I had never played in a role-playing game before. My brother had never played in a role-playing game before. Chad had played in like one D&D session or something like that. The other guy or two that we were gaming with, they had never role-played before. And so pretty much, you know, we were just, whatever the rule book said you were supposed to do, we just took as fact. And that rule book talked about how you were supposed to have maps for every location and little cardboard chits to represent every character and non-player character that you would move around those maps. And of course, this meant I always had to come with some excuse why you couldn't get off the map because that area wasn't drawn. And so there always had to be some unpassable cliff or giant aliens or something out there that just made passage to that direction impossible. For NPCs, name, personality, and a few key skills was not enough. I mean, it walked you through creating them as full characters. And for anyone who's never created a character in the fastest Star Trek game, it takes a long time to do. And I mean, it was a huge undertaking. So yeah, I would spend all this time and come to the game with these notebooks of information. And it really was not per se a personality trait that led me to do it. This was how you game, because that's what the book said I was supposed to do. So that had to be right. And I kind of had to learn through falling on my own face enough times that, no, that really doesn't work and isn't all that great of an idea. In fact, it's a terrible idea. But that was the fad of role-playing in the early to mid-80s, was more, more, more. More books, more papers, more record sheets, more classes. Oh, yeah. You know, it's just more rules, just pile thing upon thing, and surely you're improving the game in the process. The flip side of this one, next one, is improvisation. How do you teach improvisation? I mean,
you go take a theater improv. That's the best way to do it.
Is there really? I mean, do they?
Oh, sure.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean,
if you're joking or
no. I don't take them as much anymore. But with our involvement in the Renaissance Fair, one of the things that they teach in the workshops is what they call street improv or street encounters, which is when you're going up and interacting with paying customers who are coming in. They've discovered that that has a very real impact on whether or not that, what they call a patron, is whether or not they're going to come back. Did they have a personal interaction with one of the actors at the show? And if they had, their likelihood of wanting to come back skyrockets. So it's very important to the fair that people know how to do what they call street improv, which basically is teaching a lot of the techniques from the theater sports movement, concepts like yes and yes but, and all of the little weird theater games they teach you to sort of break down your inhibitions and help you deal with the fear of failure and the fear of looking silly or the fear of looking stupid. Because I think that's probably one of the reasons that people have such a hang up about going to a game without knowing exactly what's going to go on. I think that's one of the reasons people tend to over prep, so they won't have to rely on being on that cutting edge of, I don't know what's going to happen any more than the players do right now. Because it can be kind of a terrifying thing, I think, for most of us.
Well, and the punchline to that is that you can't do it anyway, because no matter how much you prepare, you will never prepare for everything the party's going to do anyway.
Exactly.
And I think the two bits of advice I would give is, first off, just do it. I mean, you might feel silly, you might make some mistakes, you might throw the game a little off the first few times you do it, but you'll learn from it. And if nothing else, you're getting yourself past that initial fear. You're teaching yourself what to do and not to do. If you can't do that, pause the game. I mean, if somebody's put you on the spot, I don't think there's any harm done in coming up with an excuse to leave the table for a minute or two, or even saying, wow, I didn't see that one coming. Give me a sec to look my stuff over and figure this one out. And I mean, don't script it, but at least kind of recenter yourself, calm down, get a keyword or two in mind, think back on your life. Okay, they're talking to this kind of person. What's the last person I met like that and how did they act? I mean, dig into your own history for some kind of inspiration and then kind of come back to the table rearmed. The way that they describe it here is, you know, for example, one of the things they throw out is derailed sessions and thinking on the feet being problems, but I don't think game masters have to do that quite so instantaneously. I mean,
I agree with you, Dan. And you said make some excuse to step away from the table. I say don't even do that, because what you have to remember is, and hopefully is the case, is that you're sitting at a table with your friends.
Right.
We're all friends here. We all know what's going on. And if something like that happens, I say the best course of action is just to be frank and honest and say, wow, you know what? I need to take a little break because this is going in a completely different direction than I thought. I need to wrap my head around it. So let's take a 15-minute break and then we'll come back or you know, however long you need and do it. You know what this isn't? This isn't a performance like on stage where, you know, if you drop your line, it's like, oh, shit.
I kind of look at it from that other side of it. One of the big brass rings I'm always reaching for when I'm GMing is player immersion. That moment where the players forget that we're sitting in this room eating potato chips and sucking down Mountain Dew and get into the point where they're into their character, and they obviously don't literally think they're their character, but they get to the point where reality kind of fuzzes away a little bit and they become really entrenched in the story. And myself, I would be reluctant to say that threw me for a loop. I'm going to go make up something and come back, because it seems to me there needs to be this thin facade that the GM had this planned all along, or that this is how things were going to happen. It's very thin, but I think interrupting that and breaking that fourth wall and saying, oh, I'm having problems coming up with a way to deal with this, excuse me for a moment, would sort of counteract everything I'm trying to do to get the players immersed into the game.
Well,
you know what I'm saying?
Falls back to, I follow what you're saying, but I wonder if this kind of falls back to distinctions between groups, because I know within our group, the fact that the fourth wall was broken, nobody would really care so long as they had fun with the result.
Sure.
So, but I don't know. Maybe that's just the difference between, you know, expectations of the group or just your desires as a GM versus, you know, what we've come to get out of gaming or whatever. So, but I do follow what you're saying.
And let me be clear. By standing up and saying, I have to go take a dump, I'm breaking that fourth wall too.
Yes.
But at least, and even some of the players will know. We threw him a curveball that time. But
this is the fourth dump he's taken in the past 20 minutes.
Exactly.
Well, and Stu, I agree with you. I think if you have that ability, if you're comfortable and confident and are able to really think on your feet quickly, I think that that is absolutely a plus and that you should do so. But I think on the other side of it too, though, is if you can't and they really throw something like that, then if you can't think on your feet fast enough, then I think it's better to just take a break
for
the sake of the story than to try to and ha and try to BS your way through it maybe. But valid points on both sides.
One more thing to say about improv, and this actually, again, comes from back in the workshops I used to take, because I really think a lot of people's reluctance and problems with improv is because they have a mental block to it. And I think part of that is the fear of looking dumb or the fear of looking stupid. And they used to have this horrible, horrible, awful game we used to have to play called Bunny Bunny, where you would get four or five people standing or in a circle around each other, and one of them would put two fingers up on either side of their head and flap them and go, Bunny 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 Bunny, and point to someone else. And that person would have to do the same thing and point to someone else. And it would go around and they'd make you do this for like 5 or 6 minutes. And finally, someone in one of our classes early on asked, what is the point of this? And the guy said, I want you to get used to feeling stupid, because that's half of what improv is. And you can't care that you feel stupid.
Mm.
You got to be able to get past that fear. And I think that has a lot to do with improv, not only in the game, but also in theater.
Years before Fear of the Boot existed, in fact, years before podcasting existed, there was a time that we as a group really did sit down, and this was in a very different iteration. This was years before I met Pat. But we sat down and we spent a lot of time kind of talking about RPGs, both as an art and a science, and even amongst ourselves, kind of dorked around with some little exercises and, you know, things like that. I've never decided, you know, in retrospect, were we just kind of being silly and taking a game way too seriously, or in some way were we really on to something? And hearing you give that little anecdote, I now kind of wonder if it's a little bit of both.
Mm-hmm.
Moving on to the next one, encounter building. Now, I realize in the traditional, very old traditional sense of the word encounter within a role-playing game, it just means any interaction between the character and the world. I presume they're using a more modern definition of encounter where it means you run into three orcs. This really isn't an issue for us because we just don't play the types of games that are driven by that. Even when we're playing Pathfinder or D&D, we don't tend to really drive the game by just a chain of encounters. And so I guess maybe for somebody who is running that type of a game, keeping those fresh and creative and distinct and whatnot, you know, people apparently specifically commented about finding inspiration for them and such. So, I mean, I guess running into a group of orcs again and again and again would start to get pretty samey. But I don't know that I will have a whole lot to say on the issue just because it's not how we game.
When I used to run 4th edition D&D, from running that, I completely understand this as being a frustration because that game is a slave to the balance god. And they ended up coming up with online tools so you could build an encounter monster by monster and you could level the monsters up or level them down so that you could have make sure you had a moderate encounter for your party or a difficult encounter for your party. The whole core books are really kind of built around the idea of the combat encounter. And I found myself spending an enormous amount of time. Oh, we should probably have a fight in this game. Okay, let me sit down. Who might they fight? And then I'll come up with and build an encounter for two or three different possibilities where swords might come out. And each of those is very time consuming. And plus the balance of the game and power curve of character advancement, there's an assumption within the way that the character advancement works that you will get X number of magic weapons at X point. And so then you have to worry about, oh, well, what kind of loot is there going to be after this? Because that's kind of part of the game balance of the whole thing. And once you start ignoring that, then suddenly moderate encounters suddenly become difficult encounters and vice versa. And I can kind of understand that. I've never GM'd Pathfinder, but from the short time I did 4th edition D&D, I can kind of get it.
Finding a consistent group. I completely get this one. We've talked about this one. In fact, I think we've dedicated a whole show portions in the past to this one. I'll reiterate some of the ideas that we gave as best as I recall them. Check with your local game shop. They may be able to put you in touch with people that are looking for players or looking for a GM. Get involved in an organized play group. Even if organized play is not your favorite thing, it's still a great way to meet new people, at least find some foot into the door of the hobby. If you're truly isolated for whatever reason, consider online gaming. There are lots of resources out there for finding people to do remote play games with. I know some people prefer face-to-face to remote play, but hey, remote play is better than no play, I guess. I mean, some people may disagree with that, but I get it. GM burnout, this one we hit on last time, so I don't feel the need to linger on this one. But once again, definitely understand the issue. Getting players to actually role play. This is one we've talked about in the past, and I think the best advice I can give on this one is make sure they thought their character through. So make sure the prep work is there. Make sure their character has a personality. They've developed some kind of a character, and then go after them. And I don't mean that in a hostile way, but I mean have somebody who's a very boisterous NPC start engaging them. Grab one of your players who is more into role playing and is more outgoing and say, hey, I want you to start doing heavy role play with this guy over here to your left. Get the person drawn in. And if they've got the base outline of the character and you start pulling them in, most people will generally get into it. I mean, it might take them a little bit, especially if it's not their thing or they're not used to it. But in my experience, most people will fall into it.
You know, something that we did back in the day, and I know that I'll start this off with a caveat of, I know that maybe a lot of groups, maybe they don't have the time to dedicate to this, but something that I found that was really kind of helpful was every once in a while, we would have like solo role-playing adventures. And what I mean by that is we had a group of four or five players in the campaign, but every once in a while, we would just do a session where it was just one player and the GM, and they would have it like a solo side adventure. And if you want to talk about really forcing that one player to role play when it's just you and the GM, if you don't, then it's just the GM sitting there talking at you the whole time. I think that it can be good in the fact that there's not the pressure there. It's a low pressure situation where maybe said shy player or not used to role playing player can be introduced sort of gradually to it and say, you know, and have to do that role playing. And I think that could help them. Now, again, I know you may not have that kind of time to dedicate, but maybe you can do just a little bit within a session. Like you can pull them aside quickly and be able to do the same right. Kind of thing too. Cause I think that can help. Cause a lot of times I think, you know, shy role players, it could just be that they're intimidated by talking in front of the group, even though it's all their friends, is still just intimidating.
To me, this question gets right back to the improv question. Because I think very often, if a player is going to be reluctant to actually sit down and portray their character in character and be in character, it is because they don't want to look silly. And then it's kind of silly. I'm Thog the Barbarian. Ugh, I'm dumb and I'm going to act dumb. You know, especially if you're not used to it, or if you're in a group, if you've never role played before, or you're in a group that doesn't tend to do that, as a GM, I think if you make sure you always refer to the players by their character names and talk to them in the first person when you're an NPC, don't fall into the trap that they're in where they're narrating what their character is saying. Say the lines and expect that sort of response back. The other thing I think that really kind of breaks the ice, especially early on, and I tend to do this in con games, is have all of the players, once they've looked at their characters and they're familiarized themselves with them, have them all introduce themselves to the rest of the group in character. Break that ice. In that sense, you're giving them permission to act silly. This is a game. We're all going to take on roles. We're going to play people that we're not. And you're going to start doing it right now. So introduce yourselves and then go around the room. And the other thing is to lead by example. Make sure that when you're playing NPCs, always make sure that you're playing those characters and you're not narrating what those characters are saying and doing, but you're actually saying it and doing it.
Sessions taking too long? I think this falls into the fear that a lot of game masters have that they don't have enough prepared. And so they tend to come over-prepared. And I don't mean over-prepared the way we talked about it before. I'm not talking about having a binder of material. But what I am talking about is the game master comes with a lot more plot than is actually needed. Mm-hmm. Or I guess depending on the type of game, if you're doing something that's encounter-heavy D&D or has very complex combat, something like Battletech, you could get something along those lines that just takes longer than you expected, and that's really got nothing to do with the plot. But if we presuppose that we're talking about the plot itself drawing on longer than you expected, I think this one's an easy one to fix, which is all you need to do is create multiple stopping points. I mean, if you think, okay, this amount of notes is what it's going to take to fill up a night, as a game master, for me, most of the time, I walk home with notes unused. And I think that's probably going to be true of most game masters. I know there's going to be people who are on the opposite extreme where it's never enough. But if that's what you're falling into, this one seems easy enough to solve, which is, look, grab your notes. And instead of having it end at the bottom of page 3, give yourself a jumping off point at page 1.5 and page 2 as well. And so you've got these multiple places where if you look at your watch and say, wow, it's getting fairly late, I don't know that I keep wanting to do this, you know, I'm getting tired or whatever, you've got a good stopping point there. Yeah. And whatever notes you didn't use, you can take for next time.
My longest sessions were in 4th edition D&D, and that's when we had like 8 to 9 players, which that game is not built to have that many players, and a combat would take 2 or 3 hours. And we had one game session, and we're old guys, so we're not used to staying up until the wee hours of the morning playing anymore. And we would start at 6 o'clock, and we'd end at like 1:30 or 2 o'clock in the morning, and everyone's exhausted.
Yeah.
And we had like 1 or 2 combats. I remember one night we went until like 2 o'clock in the morning, and then there was a shooting across the street, and the police shut down my street, and no one could leave.
So did you just keep gaming, or did you go out and join the shooting, or what?
I was too tired to keep gaming. I, like, went and got blankets and said, you guys can crash on the couches and on the floor. But when the cops let you leave, get out of my house. Yeah, there was some sort of altercation that ended with someone being shot as they were running away from a house across the street down a few. Our neighborhood used to be a little more interesting than it is now.
Yeah.
Thankfully, that's changed.
Pro tip. If they're running away, it's no longer self-defense. The last one out here, keeping track of things. I think once again, this is going to depend upon the game. Google Docs is your friend. Now, this assumes we're talking about somebody keeping track of between games. For example, in Battletech, especially if you're dealing with like a mercenary corps, you have resources. You're keeping track of things down to the individual types of parts you've got for the mechs, you know, the makes and models of everything. And I mean, possibly counting everything down to the last bullet and missile. And that can get pretty intensive. If you're dealing with something like D&D, it could be right there on the spot that maybe in between encounters, it's not so difficult. But during an encounter, keeping track of, okay, there's 12 skeletons. Where is the initiative fall for each of them versus the players? And who's got what hit points and where's everybody standing and which mini corresponds to which monster tracker and all this kind of, man, that's rough stuff. The best advice I have is there are a lot of tools out there for helping you with this. There are tools you can get in terms of putting them on your phone. I don't think we count this as a tableside distraction to help you track all that kind of stuff. I've seen these great little magnetic tools where you can put, they have little dry erase magnets that you can use to write names on them, move them into initiative order, and you make little notes about hit points or stuff to the side of them. If you're playing an online game, then there's, oh, what is it called now? The table, it's still Tabletop Forge. No, it's Roll20. It's called Roll20 now. There's several play tops like that that help you keep track of all that kind of stuff. Maybe if you're playing even face to face, you still use one of those just for the sake of keeping track of stuff. I mean, man, computers are your friends in this one. Mm-hmm. But I do understand how in many games, I mean, some games are pretty streamlined or so conceptual that you really don't have to worry about that too much. Some of the iterations of Fate in particular, there's, you don't have to keep track of anything more than who's got what chips. But I do fully understand how in some games keeping track of the minutiae, either between games or during the games, can be very burdensome. And what I would say is look for tools. You are not the first GM to have this problem, and people have spent a lot of time and money and energy making tools that they have kindly made available to you, whether for sale or for free, to help you with the problems they have already been having. So get out there and look around, because you will find tools in all probability to help you with what you're dealing with.
Mm-hmm. You know, the thing I've been looking for is an NPC manager, something where I can put in a location and say, I'm in this city, especially for Legend of the Five Rings, because there's a lot of NPCs in it. But I put in this location and it just gives me the list. Here are the 12 NPCs that you've created for this location.
Oh, here's, that would be nice. You know,
and I can't find, and I'm, someone suggested, I don't remember, Realm Works just came out. There's a Wolf Slayer that does it. I don't remember. But someone said that that might be able to handle something like that. But that's something that I would love to have, where I can just go in and say, here's my location, here's the NPCs there. I can go in and change the information on them as it goes, save it back.
It strikes me you could even do that in a spreadsheet, whether Google Doc or Excel or whatever. Just be sure you have a column that is location, and then sort by that column, or maybe make each of your locations a tab on that spreadsheet or something. I don't know. Yeah. I mean, maybe not a perfect solution, but it seems better than trying to thumb through a three-ring binder of 200 pages to find who's where, and then, oh, yeah, I forgot about so-and-so. And
right.
We've reached the end of this individual's list. Now, we are, per fan request on our forums, we are still going to come back at some point here and revisit an older show topic of our own, which is common player mistakes and common GM mistakes. That will be done from our perspective, but I thought Lane put together a great list, and I really appreciate the work that was done on this, and so I felt it was worth covering once again. I will link to that in the show notes. We did skip over some of the things that Lane talked about, so if you want to see the full list plus all of his explanations and some of the interactions that he was having with people asking questions about it, then by all means, please follow that out there and take a look at what's been put together. And Stu, I want to thank you for joining us. And when you duck back inside, thank Kimmy for joining us as well in the prior episode.
Absolutely. Thank you for having us.
And as for you guys at home, you have a great week and great games. And we will catch you next time.
See ya. Is Chad very possessive about that?
This has been a production of Fear the Boot, copyright 2014. Listeners are free to use this show in any non-commercial endeavor as long as credit is provided to feartheboot.com. You can find previous episodes and other resources at feartheboot.com. Fear the Boot is also a member of the Pulp Gamer Media Network of shows. You can find other great shows in this network at pulpgamer.com.